All right, Khaled Talhouni, welcome to our episode 3 of the podcast. It's great to have you here, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Good way to reconnect.
Absolutely. It's been such a long time. It's been a long time coming as well. First of all, how are you enjoying your Jordanian sage? I think we're both stuck here. We can't travel back home. It's good to have a taste of Jordan here in Dubai.
I know. I don't think I've had this since I left Jordan maybe 15 years ago, but still, it's great.
This is from Wild Jordan. I was thinking I want to give a shout out both to this, local. In fact, I was going to tell you about when I was 3 months ago when lockdown started. Mm-hmm. Aisha Shah and Hannah Shah sent me a basket at a gesture of like, we miss you, we can't see you guys. Right. It's such a lovely gesture from a place called Mama Ish.
Have you tried it? It's great. Yeah,
and if we had some of the olives and the makdous, which we wiped in the first weeks, I would have given you some. But what a horrible time to have lived through over the last few months. And the only way we could connect with people and friends was through sending them like kind of products.
Care packages.
How has the quarantine been with you? And specifically, well, I guess let me take a step back and you know, mention that you launched your first VC fund. Your first entrepreneurial venture, so congratulations. It's been a long time coming. It's a $100 million fund focused on tech startups in the region, fintech, mobility, enterprise solutions. I'd love to hear more about this from you. But how has it been to step into your first entrepreneurial venture after being on the investment side for the last more than 10 years, especially in the times that we're in, which are tough for everybody, especially entrepreneurs? So tell us a little bit more about that.
Firstly, like the nature of my job has always been like working with founders and with entrepreneurs and looking to invest in their businesses and help support them grow. So I think when you do that, you kind of develop this way of living vicariously through the entrepreneur. So you get stuck with that bug, right? You wanna do something entrepreneurial. You do that through the entrepreneurs you work with, even though you're not really managing or operating those businesses, but you're just adjacent to it. The more you do it, the more you feel like this is something I want to do. But I also love the investing side, and I'm probably much better suited as a person to be not an operator, and much more a kind of as an investor. So I was thinking, how do I combine them rather than having a startup? Can I have like a startup fund, as it were? And to your point, long time coming. I've been thinking about it for a long time, and kind of we stepped into it. We launched in February, so we announced the fund at Step earlier this year, and then the whole plan was, you know, we locked with a core anchor investor, which was the Faisalia Group, who are also our partners in the fund. And the idea was, we'll announce at Step, we'll make a bit of noise, and then we'll hit the road with a roadshow and raise the funds, the rest of the capital in mid-March.
Yeah.
It didn't work out that way because like mid-March was when the world fell apart, basically. So on one side, I think it was one of the most kind of interesting things to have lived through. It was one of the scariest things I've ever lived through. Not because worried about the pandemic or about getting sick, but, you know, just kind of stepped into, building a business with as any founder knows, and I never really appreciated, even though I've been doing this for 10 years investing in founders, there's no safety net, right? It falls apart, what happens? So I think it was like that initial period was really shaky and a bit scary, you know? And especially since like I had others, foolish enough to kind of jump ship with me. So like, you know, Sarah, Abu Risha and Stephanie, my partners in the fund, they came along as well, and they took that leap. So bearing the responsibility of other people as well was a very serious kind of. There's a lot of like self reflection at that time.
I was gonna say, with the three of you leaving Wamda together, did you guys all leave at the same time, or was it?
No, it was kind of staggered, but it was agreed like before, so it was kind of like a very negotiated, amicable, positive like exit. Okay. And I'm still involved in like some of the portfolio companies and stuff.
Right. And so, what are some of the specific difficulties that you've noticed that are related to Corona? Because I'm sure starting your own fund has its own challenges in any time.
Yeah.
But is it more like investors are a little bit more cautious on where they want to put their money in? Or is it more operational and attracting talent? How do the challenges of Corona affect an entrepreneur who's starting a VC fund?
So on the fund side, it's clearly as you lock down the world, right? Like there's economic freefall, which is what we saw. Like the markets were they were down 40%. You had unemployment rates in like the US go up to like 20-30% at some points. And so it was clear that this was a very serious moment of potential economic collapse, right? And so that's not the right timing to go out while people's businesses are hurting, whether they're, you know, traditional sources of wealth in the region or elsewhere, and say, oh, do you want to invest do you want to invest in something, right? Yeah. It's always like a bit, it was just very tone deaf and not the right moment to kind of go ahead and do that. Whereas, you know, in the moment leading up to that, we had a lot of interest from investors, and some of them disappeared, right? Their businesses took a huge hit. With all the economic uncertainty, it's very hard to kind of raise capital for anyone, right? Let alone someone trying to raise a fund, right? And so there was so much uncertainty then. And I should say, like, I was quite reliant on our partners, Faisalia, at the time. And, you know, when you enter a partnership for the first time, you don't know how it's going to end up, but I say this all sincerity, I think they were so supportive, Yanni.
What is their exact, are they just funding, are they investing in the fund, or are they operationally involved?
So they own part of the GP, which is like the company, basically. And they're like they were the first in the large investor in the fund. But they were incredibly supportive, Yanni, throughout. And I think it's really solidified, Yanni, knock on wood, that relationship. So you know, at the time I felt like all this, you know, have I made a huge mistake? Like, what was I thinking? You know, I could just stay, you know, I could have like done totally different path. But I think it was sort of inevitable, and I felt good about that. I was worried about the responsibility of like being with other people who depend that took the jump with me.
Yeah.
And whether we'd be able to see it through. I think at the time I remember thinking that, is this going to be the best timing ever or the worst timing ever? And we repeat that a lot. I think,
although you started before Corona, right?
Right, so, before, like, yeah. We announced it was almost like the day we signed, right? Like it was really close, right? And I left like Wanda right like then, right? So it was there was no interim period, right? So it was just up there, but so it'd be like the worst possible time to kind of start a business and particularly start a fund, like to fundraise. Or it would be perfect timing, because if you look at the timings or the vintages of funds that start during like major downturns in VC, you see that they tend to outperform, you also see that a lot of the world's most innovative companies come out of that time. So to keep ourselves sane at that time, myself, Sarah, and Stephanie, who like my partners, we set out to kind of like, how do we keep ourselves sane as the world's collapsing? So we put together this deck that's like made the rounds a bit. I'll share it with you after.
Okay.
We called it like Love in the Time of Cholera.
Okay.
Right? After the, and just talking about how, yes, you know, the bottom seems to be falling out every day. There's a worse story, right? Either on the healthcare, on the health side, or on the economic side. But look at the opportunities and look at how our society is being reshaped. And actually, you know, technology or tech being tech enabled or the tech enabled sector, and we can talk about that in a bit, is just poised for rapid expansion. And that was just beginning to happen in March. You're seeing like suddenly like everything's falling apart, but innovation was kind of taking hold. And I think that was what was super interesting. So we put a deck around that, and I'll share it. I haven't done that already, but I should share that with you.
So one of the things that I did a bit of research before our podcast, and I saw some figures that are quite interesting, and they're in line with exactly what you're saying. So one of them was the fact that I think there's some like $500-600 million of dry powder or liquidity that's sitting on the sidelines from investors. This is money that's already invested in funds, ready to be deployed in MENA startups. So clearly after we get out of this, there's no shortage of liquidity. You're already in the process of raising, or may have already completed the fundraising. Yeah. So I think once life is back in order, there's not going to be shortage of investors that want to just like take this to the next stage, right?
Yeah. So what happened with us is, you know, we had that kind of little bit of a, like I would say a bit of a, you know, moment of uncertainty. But what, as it became more apparent to everyone else that like digital was here to stay, and we were like really on the cusp of like a once in a generation transformation, We started getting a lot of inbound interest from investors, which was surprising to me. It was not what till today we've not done a roadshow per se, and so we got a lot of this inbound interest, and we're just in the process of converting it now, like 6 months later, and I think we'll hit our target. I think, alhamdulillah, over the next couple of months, I think we'll get to where we need to get to. And we've been busy. We've started doing investments. We invest in a number of companies, some announced, some unannounced. We're about to announce a couple.
So I was one of them, right?
I was the first one. We've done another two now. I would say we'll probably hit a stride of one every 6 weeks, more or less. Might accelerate a bit more. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to deploy very aggressively with our investors. Our investors have made some capital available to do that.
One of the things that really caught my attention about your fund, and it's something that I remember you were talking about a lot back when you were at Lambda, is the value-adding role that VCs should be playing with their portfolio companies and the lack of that happening in this space. And I think one of the things that underlines your thesis and your value proposition to the startups is that you're not going to be just another VC, but you're very much focused on the founders. So it's very founder-centric. And it's meant to add value. And I think the two things that I came across, and I'd love to hear more about you on those on that front, is that you're going to share the upside, the gain, that financially speaking.
Yeah.
But in addition, also, you're going to provide a deliberate network of subject matter experts and business partners who are going to collaborate with the founders and founders with each other as well. So could you talk a little bit more about that part of your
fund? So I think like one of the realizations of doing this for the past like over 10 years is that, you know, and comparing that to other parts of the world, particularly like the Bay Area or Silicon Valley and even like Asia, like China, is that starting a tech business here and scaling it is really hard. It's not the same as it's nowhere near kind of the ease at which you do that elsewhere in the world. And starting a business anywhere in the world is hard. So you have this additional layer of complexity in the region. I mean, the simplest one to explain is like the fact that you know tech companies scale multi country here. You can't be like an Emirati only company or a Jordanian company or an Egyptian company, with some exceptions. But on the whole, you have to have a regional footprint. And how do you operate in multiple jurisdictions? It's like, it's really complicated, difficult. I think we have other complexities from the fact that we're a nascent ecosystem, meaning that it's hard to find people who've been through the cycle 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. So if you want to hire a great operations head of operations, for example, for your business, you know, if you were sitting in Silicon Valley, you'd compete for the talent, right? You'd have to go find someone. You'd have to kind of convince someone to come join you. Whereas here it's like there is nobody, right? Like how do you get that advice? We wanted to kind of build a platform where we have real support for the founders that we work with. So if they have a tech problem, they can talk to a kick-ass CTO who can really help them.
Nice.
If they have a product issue, then we will cover the cost of them talking to like someone in our network who's a product guy or a marketing person, growth hacking guy. Or if you need recruitment, then we have a recruitment partner, so they can like do that. And we want to do that in a structural way. Typically, VCs here and elsewhere in the world, like globally, it's very network driven. So it's very like, I know someone, a great recruiter, so I'll, you know, but I wanted to kind of like productize it as much as possible
and
institutionalize it. Exactly. Rather than it just being, you know, depending on, I can call this guy, which you still do, but it becomes much more structured.
And explain to me a little bit how the sharing of the gain of the carry, right? So if I'm a startup that has a valuation of $20 million, you invest in my company, my valuation after 5 years is $100 million. Normally, I would make the upside on the valuation of my stocks increasing. But you're saying that in your case, you'll also share over and above. Is this my understanding correct?
Yeah. So basically, like, you know, it's all about, again, like aligning founders and institutionalizing, productizing the support. So like, you know, the other thing that you learn is that, you know, who do founders benefit the most from? Actually, it's other founders who've been through the cycle. So in terms of kind of like thinking long term about building this platform, how do you align and incentivize founders around once they've been through the cycle and they exit and they get to the next stage? How do I get them to give back to kind of the growing entrepreneurs and be aligned with our platform in the long run? And I think, you know, one way is just to kind of share some of our own upside in that, so that they feel a sense of camaraderie in the portfolio, but also that in the very long run, if you go to fund two, fund three, fund four, whatever, they feel part of this platform. This is the founder's platform without me being myself like a former founder. So
that's awesome. Has anybody ever done this before? Because I've never heard of it before.
No, I think there's a small, there's a new fund in the UK called Kindred that I think just launched with this similar principle. I think I mean, in full honesty, I wasn't aware of what they were doing. But on the founder support side, I was really inspired by Andreessen Horowitz, where they have a huge operating pool of like what they call operating partners that help support their portfolio companies. Also launched during a downturn.
Right.
Like you'll see like even innovation in the venture model tend to come up during like economic
That's certainly innovative to actually share the upside with founders and entrepreneurs that are willing to share their time and their expertise with the entire portfolio. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. It aligns the incentives. I've never heard of it before. As an entrepreneur myself who raised money, I would totally be up for, you know, generally there's a desire to collaborate and help other fellow entrepreneurs anyway. Mm. But then when you do it in a little bit of a structured way, it's like a win-win situation for everybody.
I think that's just, we're kind of evolving the model as well. So it's kind of the first step around alignment with the founders. It's not that, you know, the founders will get rich from this kind of carry. It's not that much, right? But it's much more about...
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It's about the posture, right? It's about the positioning and a posture that, you know, we want to be meaningful partners. And we'll part a bit with our pocketbooks, with our upside, to kind of demonstrate to you that we're for real.
Yeah.
But then the idea is to constantly build on the platform, to kind of evolve the VC model or the investment model, which is being reshaped anyway.
Yeah.
And I think we start here, and like all startups, we will pivot and evolve along the way.
Yeah.
Where we'll end up, I don't know. But I think what we're going to try and do is continuously like take learnings and like build on the business.
Well, I think last time we went out for dinner, which I think was maybe around 2 years ago, the deal for Careem was still being, you know, happening. It didn't take place yet, but I think you guys were investing in it, and there was potentially the exit that happened a few months ago. I wanted to ask you about Mudassir Sheikha, because I remember at the time you spoke very highly of this particular founder, and I know you've seen maybe 1,000 founders by now over your last 10 years, if not more.
No, probably around like 7,000-8,000.
Oh, that's the actual number. Wow.
I think about 7,000-8,000. Yeah, over the course of my career, probably. Right. Yeah.
So, rather than talking about who are some of the people that will stick in your mind as the jackpots? Maybe you can tell me a little bit more about the blueprint that, you know, because when you are a VC, you are selecting winners. A lot of that has to do much more with the person, their personality, their intrinsic skills, their soft skills. Less so about the product and the market, because that's going to pivot a million times probably by the time that a company exits. So Mudassir as an example, but maybe you want to talk a little bit more about the broader blueprint that made you decide who are the winners that you want to invest in.
Right.
Yeah.
So I can, okay. So maybe, honey, I'll bring this to you in reverse.
Okay.
Right?
Sure.
One thing you noticed, and we always kind of talk about and joke about, is that some of the most successful founders in the region, the common thread throughout, and this is not very helpful at the onset, but at the outcome level, you realize that the most success, and there are notable exceptions, but on the whole, they tend to be extremely humble. There's an extreme humility to them that is remarkable. So you look at the likes of Mudassir, incredibly humble, like, you know, he has this incredible ability. He just has not gone to his head, you know, at all. And throughout, right, from day one. If you look at like Samih Tuqan, Hussam Khoury, who arguably have had some of the largest exits in the region, right, starting with Maktoub and through to Souq, with also Ronaldo being the founder there, Ronaldo Mshahwar. The three of them, Ronaldo, Hussam, and Samih, incredibly humble, right? Like extreme humility, you know, like, and they have no sense of like
arrogance.
It's I think it's quite amazing. I mean, Rabia Ataya from Bayt, similar. It tends to be Hussam Arab from Namshi, you know, like, you know, is arguably also one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the region. Very, very extremely grounded, has a good sense of like, you know, that, you know, what it took to get there. And it seems to be sort of a common thread. Mm-hmm. And can you screen for that at the beginning? No, because there are other exceptions that don't look like that, right? That tend to end up with good outcomes. But and most people, I think on the whole, tend to have humility, right? Mm-hmm. Like most people are not very arrogant. You just need the right mix of kind of ego and as a drive, right? Without that then go to your head. But when you look at the beginning, I think this is another thing I did once, and I think, you know, we said we never kind of talk about it openly, but like the profile of a successful founder in our region, if you put that up, it's not typically, you know, college. It's not Mark Zuckerberg, didn't like drop out of
movie stories.
But even that is a bit of false, kind of, because Mark Zuckerberg and like Bill Gates, whoever, they went to Harvard. They dropped out, yes, but they went to kind of great universities. They come from upper middle class to kind of wealthy families. But what's in the public imagination is this kind of scrappy 20-year-old who's like a drifter or whatever, like more like Steve Jobs. But Steve Jobs is that as well. But the narrative we have is not that. I think what we have in our region is that the tend to be the more successful outcomes for founders today are probably a bit older. So like, you know, mid-career professionals, so 30 to 35, 28 to 35, like that range, up to 40. They tend to have kind of blue chip educational credentials. You know, they went to great colleges, you know. And then they've had interesting career experience, right? So you talk about like Mudassir, like, you know, and, you know, McKinsey, you know, he's like, you know, has been through the cycle before, he exited the company before, or been part of the company that exited before in the US, and has had that kind of experience. So they tend to be, you know, not the scrappy, you know,
young and,
kid, like from the wrong side of the tracks, like working class background, who's kind of just a genius and figure that. I'd love for that to be like true. And, it, you know, I'm sure there are some stories that look like that. The reality is it's not. And I think like one of the things that's worrying about VC is that, or we think about entrepreneurship in general, is that, you know, it's framed, particularly in emerging markets, by this narrative that, you know, it's an impact thing that, you know, we're going to help the poorest in society rise up, and that's not necessarily the case with, like, you know, this sort of investing or this sort of approach. Even though that a lot of times it's framed that way, you know, especially like in places like Sub-Saharan Africa or even in MENA to some degree.
Right.
So we might not end up with the outcomes we think we're going to end up with.
Right.
But anyway, that's a different thing.
So actually, I was going to ask you: have you, you know, when you follow a certain criteria on which founding teams you're going to invest in or which ideas or industries.
Yeah.
Have you ever, what are some of the investments that come to mind that you were surprised? So you didn't expect success to happen, and against all odds, this company or these founders turned out to be much more successful than you would have initially thought, at least against all odds as far as other investors are concerned. Similarly, you said that there are many companies that would have checked all boxes on paper, but somehow they might have disappointed or not step up to the expectations. Do you feel like your framework and your criteria is the accuracy, or how how accurate, or how are your expectations met? Are they usually met sufficiently, or do you find yourself often surprised with the outcome?
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, the funny thing is, and it's so hard to kind of quantify this or actually like figure out how to kind of turn this into like an effective strategy. But typically, your initial reaction is the correct one.
Yeah,
it rarely is the wrong one. But then so much rationalization goes on after that first 10 minutes or 5 minutes or 15 minutes in that meeting and in subsequent meetings and subsequent conversations, that, you know, those rationalizations can be quite pollutive to the process, right? But then, you know, how do you just make a 5 minute, like, you know, it seems unfair, right? Like, seems wrong, you know? And sometimes your gut reaction is wrong, but 9 times out of 10, that first 10 minutes is almost like,
yeah,
you know, it's almost on, almost right.
Right. That whole thing about initial gut feeling is actually,
I think it's like pattern recognition. And it's about, you know, I think like a lot of smart people trying to figure out how to take that pattern recognition into something structured. I've not figured it out. But like, you know, in the Bay Area, this is a huge kind of, in Silicon Valley, it's like a huge thing. Like, how do you kind of like capture that and build on it? I think we're trying to do that through like capturing a lot of information and data, but we're just scratching the surface. I don't know how we're going to end up with a, that's the holy grail, right? Like, how do you kind of,
Before you came over, I was looking at the report that was produced by Magnet for the first half of 2020. Philip Bahosh is doing a great job.
Awesome. Yeah. He's great.
One of the things that struck me initially, did you see the talk that he had with Fadi Ghandour? He had a talk with Fadi Ghandour recently.
I don't think I did, actually. But I saw the write-up of it.
Right.
But I didn't watch the actual thing, no.
So a couple of key insights that came to me straight from the report. One of them is that funding in terms of value is not much lower than it should have been in 2019 due to the pandemic. But the reason why, or at least the number of deals, was much lower. So basically a lot of the money
that seems... concentration, yeah.
Correct. So a lot of the money is going to like four or five later stage deals. Some of them were the emerging markets, property group, EMPG, Visita.
Selenicar.
Kitopi, Selenicar, exactly. So there's like five later stage, late stage startups that seem to have carried like 20 or 30% of the funding, which is around $260 million, if I'm not mistaken. But what was quite a... So that's not bad news necessarily, because that means there's still a desire from investors to invest. But one figure that was quite alarming is all the accelerated ventures. There was around a 35% drop in funding deals, so number of deals that would have happened compared to 2019. So if you look at the chart, it kind of dips.
Yeah.
Fadi had avoided commenting on this. He said it was too early to make a comment on whether this is an area of concern. Philip specifically asked him, is he concerned? And he said, look, it's too early. It's been 4 or 5 months of Corona. Do you think that the startups that are too early stage that would normally be accelerated are in a dangerous spot where everybody else wants to put their money in something safer?
I think like the initial few months of like COVID is that, you know, outside of like the very clear winners, right, or like the companies that are Series B and C, I think everyone was like watching to see what's going to happen. So, you know, it was hard to kind of raise a $1-2 million, and people did, but they're not as many as you'd have hoped. But I think there's less hope, there's less kind of danger of like a slowdown, because one, I think it's clear that a lot of the green shoots in the economy, if you want to invest in something, this is what you should invest in, you know, unless you're doing like very specific distress situations, right? And then secondly, there has been now, especially in the past year or maybe 18 months, like a coming online of a large number of smaller funds, particularly driven by like government LP money. So you have like 10 to 30, 10 to $40 million funds like that are online. And those are going to, by just by nature of their size, going to focus on the earlier stage of the market. So I think you will have like, you know, it'll come back up in terms of those earlier earlier stage deals is going to start happening more and more. I think there is, though, a little bit of a problem around the $5 to $10 million investment mark, where it's like A to B, you know, I think you start running out of steam there. And I think at the larger end also, I mean, who do you go to for a $30 million check in the Middle East? You know, it's tough. You know, it's not easy. The same, by the way, when I say the region, I say...
So it's not big enough for VC money? It's not small enough for angel money? Is this why...
No, it's like, there are no funds of size that can like cut... Because if you want to cut let's say it's a $30 million round, then you have to cut a $15 to $20 million check, really, if you're going to lead it and do it, you know, properly. You know, private equity in the region is dead, right? Dead as a doornail, right? Like, there are no, you know, institutionalized GPLP funds in private equity. They've just, you know, post-Abrage, that's one, but there are, like, lots of other kind of bad stories out there, right? And there are no kind of large enough VCs, right? So who's going to cut the big... And it's really by exception, right? You have, like, STV, you know, or you have maybe Sanabil, which is part of PIF. But there's not there is no kind of industry around that. And you go to Turkey, it's quite similar, you know, issues. You go to like East Africa, Kenya, similar. Pakistan, though earlier, so but there's nobody even on the horizon like who can do that. So there is that bit of valley of death, you know, like $10 to $20 million, $30 million. Like who can cut that check? And not many. And I think that's a big opportunity. So even though, I mean, contrary to what you would infer, is that yes, a lot of the deals were captured by like those larger tickets, but I think going forward there aren't that many people who can do that. So actually that's my main worry, is like when you get to like Series A or B, then who's gonna write the big check, you know? That's the bigger question. But that's a problem, at least for me, when I think about it, like 2 years in the future, not right now, for when the portfolio starts kind of developing.
Right The other thing that I noticed is that a lot more, the number one vertical in terms of number of deals was fintech. So 16% of all the deals were in fintech. But you know, I personally haven't heard of any fintech innovations or startups in the region raising money. In fact, in terms of value, they were not even on the top five. So that clearly, it indicated to me that these are a lot of small startups.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, and I know your fund is very much focused on fintech as well.
It's one of the areas kind of we're interested in. So I'll tell you what's going on with fintech. Yeah. So basically, like, you know, financial institutions, you know, traditional financial institutions in the region, like banks, whatever, they, I mean, they've just like, you know, done such a poor job, right? Like trying to kind of, just leaving a lot of money on the table, really. Like they will do a lot of disenfranchise, disenfranchise potential customers. So, you know, try getting a loan. The UAE is actually a lot better, but you go elsewhere in the region, go to like Jordan, for example, and try to get a small business loan for your Zanda if you have like a small supermarket.
Mm.
It's nearly impossible, right? Like you need to like give 10 personal guarantees and collateralize your left kidney, and like it's it's impossible.
Yeah.
But that's like 85% of the population, right? And so we have this massive like $300 billion credit gap across the region. And that's just kind of the, and that's for small businesses, let alone individuals, right? Like who are, should be credit worthy, but just, you know, they're not of interest to the financial institutions. So I think now that the regulators have starting to kind of like unlock this, which you're seeing like big movements in that in Jordan, in Saudi with Sama, in the UAE through like the IFC and ADGM, you're seeing like a loosening of the regulatory environment and making it much more easier to kind of address these issues. I think that's where like there's been a rush of movement to start businesses that do that. And the opportunity is massive. Like it's just, you know, the lending is one, but you know, you go across the board. I'll give you like another example. If you're, let's say middle income, professional, and yeah, and your average savings is like $10,000-$20,000. So let's say you're a government civil service person in Saudi or in the GCC in general, you maybe have like $20,000 worth of savings. That's probably sitting in cash. You have no access to, like, you're not, you know, you're maybe a teacher or a civil servant or whatever. You have no access to kind of, you're not going to invest day trade on the S&P 500. There's no 401k equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
There's no local, like capital markets here, like, you know, very, there are no kind of savings on for the long tail, or there are, but they're very few. So how do you make like 10, 12% on your $10,000 mm-hmm. a year? You don't really, you just put it, you might buy real estate at some point, or you just kind of forget about it, keep it in cash. You put it in a deposit, right? That earns you nothing. So like, how do you enfranchise people to kind of like give them access to financial markets?
Right. So it's like empowering people to get loans that otherwise would be unable to do so,
on the
and investing
side.
Retail investors getting 10-12%.
Yeah. It's just say, I mean, it's like the equivalent in the US would be a 401k. Just put my money in like, you know, savings account that like I don't worry about, or buy a mutual fund. There's no equivalent, There's no real equivalent like at scale.
Well, how do you feel about crypto and Bitcoin and the blockchain in general as far as financial services are concerned? Is it an area that you're bullish about?
Yeah, I think like blockchain, so blockchain generally as a technology is super interesting around like that. Anything that like reduces friction in transactions, I think is really interesting. And I think it's more of a B2B play than a B2C play, like around the blockchain, around the like distributed ledger technology generally. In terms of like cryptos, cryptocurrencies as an asset class, like I don't do any retail investing, by the way, of any type, right?
Not even U.S. securities? Or
buy the index and I just sit on it. I don't do anything.
Okay.
Because like I think in the very long run, can I make a 12% return on the index on the ETF? I can. Do I really want a day to, I earlier when like the world was falling apart, I wanted to entertain myself and like distract myself. I wanted to do a VIX trade where I wanted to, the VIX was like a, you know, I knew it was going to go to like sky high, like Corona, and it was still like at like, you know, 2018 or something. I was like, I'm buying, but I couldn't get set up a trading account quickly enough. So I missed it.
Yeah.
But that's it. But that's because I was like certain frame of mind. But normally
So you're still investing in US securities, but you're doing it as an index.
I don't want
to. You don't try to select winners and losers.
No,
right?
I just don't want to do it. Yeah.
So there was one guy, I forgot his name or even his name of his fund, but he does a similar strategy. And what he does is he invests in an index, but he just he says it's easier to pick out the losers than the winners.
Yeah, so he can like extrapolate from that. Yeah.
He just filters out what he considers obvious losers, so he ends up getting even better than the index.
Yeah.
But not by selecting winners, but by filtering out the losers, yeah. basically. So that's one way to do
it. I think that's doable if you have the time and you want to do it. But yeah. like
he has a fund. Yeah.
yeah, that's what he does, right? Yeah, like, yeah. people love it, and like it's people do well. But I think I'm yet to see someone, or not someone. I'm sure there are people out there, but like. Can you, in a 10-year horizon, like really beat the S&P 500 all the time?
Yeah, I guess that's... I've been recently day trading, swing trading,
yeah.
and I watch a lot of YouTubers, and I follow a lot of people on Reddit, and all the underground of investing, yeah. and these guys are fucking crazy.
Yeah,
I'm going to be dropping F-bombs on this weather, so I hope it's
Go
okay.
for it, yeah.
Potentially. So... there are people who are turning like $100,000 to $1 million within 3-4 months, and they're doing option trading mostly, which is kind of gambling.
Yeah, yeah. But I think the big thing is like long term, right? So right. there's so many people now who bought like when the market tanked, like was 40% down.
Yeah.
When was it? Like
March,
mid March. Yeah. By towards third week of March,
you doubled your money if you just bought the index.
Yeah. But then if you kind of like you say like took out the loot, if you just bought like some tech stocks,
right.
then you were like you're up maybe like more than double or 3x, 4x if you just depending on how you did it. So, but then it's not about that thing. The problem with like retail trading is time scale. So yes, I'm sure people made a ton of money.
And, yeah.
But have people made a 10-year horizon more than the S&P 500 without like a lot of work and effort and like you know.
Yeah, probably Warren Buffett continues to be on that list, although he had to sell everything at the
Even now, he probably likes this one. He didn't get right at all. No, right? So,
unless we have another crash, that's going to be even worse than the last one. Then maybe. but I want to ask you about EdTech only because I have a problem with education in general. I've had some of my own thoughts. The entrepreneur in me constantly thinks this has got to be fixed, and I don't think the solution is EdTech. So let me tell you a little bit more about that, and then I want to hear your thoughts on it. I think, and I think I heard it by the Galloway NYU professor. You know what I'm talking about?
Scott Galloway.
He said it ever so eloquently, which is that universities are for certification, not for education,
mm-hmm.
which is true. And we all know that. So the idea of going to a class, whether it's an offline brick and mortar class or going to a virtual Zoom class, to me, it's a big waste of time. Having to do this for 3-4 years right at the, when you're at your prime, and you're 18, 19, you're fully curious, very energetic, is such a waste of time and potential as education. The idea of having to sit and receive theory and content when all of this content is readily available on YouTube and everywhere else, and doing it in a classroom environment is such a waste of time. So do you think that the improvement that education is on the cusp of, is it a digital solution where you can just replace universities that are offline with online classes or similar? Or is it changing the entire curriculum, which is more content-based into a more experiential? Do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great, great, like, I love thinking about this. But
yeah.
Even though I have nothing to do with education, but it's like it's one of those things that like I spend a lot of time like, just thinking about reading about whatever. So, I think about it through the entrepreneurial lens. So like 100% agree that universities are, you know, there is an aspect of universities that's really about certification and the knowledge is one and the same. So if you go to Harvard versus you go to like wherever, like community college somewhere or the equivalent, right? The knowledge is the same. Okay, maybe then it becomes like, the person giving the instructors are better because, you know, they're Nobel laureates. But actually, Nobel laureates don't make for great professors, yeah, just as a general point.
Yeah.
So what is it that, like, that's the value here?
Mm-hmm.
So the certification part, you know, the provision of knowledge as it is, as knowledge in the didactic sense, yeah, is... I think that can be easily disrupted and should be disrupted, mm-hmm. right? And that's kind of like a messy, it's sort of something that's why like college in the US keeps becoming, globally becomes more and more expensive every year beyond the inflation. It's because right. like you cannot scale it. It's like, you know, there are different kind of issues around how productive it is. So that can be fixed. I think though the value of going to university, and this is, thinking of this like from the entrepreneurial mindset,
yeah.
is that it's not about, you know, getting a great degree in your subject. It's about the liberal arts, really. So I think university, on at least on the instruction side, becomes incredibly valuable around exposing individuals to different areas of the human experience that they wouldn't otherwise, right?
Okay.
So whether that's, you know, literature or sort of philosophy, or whether it's, you know, could be ballroom dancing, could be anything, right? I think that really enriches your thinking of the world and your ability to be innovative, because you start to grasp, you know, the understanding of like human society in a much more meaningful way than you know, if you're a great engineer, you know, and which matters, like STEM right. matters, right? But you need to kind of have that, you need to balance it just as importantly with that wider liberal arts focus, which is one of the major issues with our universities in the region, right? Mm. There is a neglect of the liberal arts, right? We don't like the liberal arts. We don't believe in it.
Because you can't get paid from them, basically.
Yeah, you can't get it. Be an engineer or be a lawyer. But, I mean, be an engineer, right? But there needs to be, I think, a real focus on that liberal arts. And like the you know, one really corny story that's repeated a lot, which is, but I think it's super important.
Mm.
Is, you know, Steve Jobs went to Reed College and he took a calligraphy class, and like the typeface and the idea for the OS came out of that design and calligraphy course that he did, because you get kind of exposed to a world that you become passionate about.
Wow.
So you know, if he went to like you know, if he just got a comp sci degree, never came up with this. It's
yeah.
also like liberal arts, when you fuse history, culture, philosophy, it creates dialectic mindset, like where you create conflicts in your head that you have to resolve,
yeah.
right? And thinking through alternative viewpoints. And I think that really matters if you want to build an innovation economy, right?
So it's more the discussion that would happen between classmates and their teacher.
Exactly.
Rather than the content.
You said it much better. I went a long-winded way of saying just that. It's not about like sitting in that classroom and listening to, like, you know, this great professor tell you, you know, blah, blah. It's about your interaction with the professors and your fellow students and the lecturers and the environment. And that's invaluable.
Yeah.
Is there a better way to do that besides the quote-unquote current university system? Maybe. But I'm yet to see it, right?
Like, so I was thinking, like, in terms of the context of business. I studied business. I went on to work in management consulting, and I ended up launching a couple of companies. And obviously I'll say this right off the bat, nothing I learned in the classroom in university was what I had came valuable to me, but maybe the discussions with the teacher, the workshops, the, you know, the case studies a little bit. But even then, what I did at work was far more valuable, including the trainings, by the way. So the trainings that you get, which are more theory based at work, where you sit in a room and there's somebody giving, far more valuable, far more relevant to the day to day work that you're going to have to do. And so I was thinking that, like, the change that would be needed, that would also apply to different types of disciplines, would be to have a more practical based curriculum, where almost like an internship. So if you're a business student, you go to college at the age of 18 and you are thrown right into deep water. So you're going to be working directly on Excel and PowerPoint as far as tools. You're going to have simulated CEO meetings and client meetings and outsourced client services.
Yeah.
And so you end up doing, like, what is effectively a 3-year internship potentially. And then you go into the real work environment where you kind of have 3 years of work experience. Now, it's not exactly, you haven't been paid for them. In fact, you are the one who's paying money. But I know they do that in medicine. I know they do that in certain verticals. But when it comes to university, it continues to be a channel for content delivery. It's not meant to be a simulation of how work in that particular space is. And that's where I find that potentially that would be the area of innovation that would be beneficial.
Yeah, I think it, like, you know, you think university as a pre-professional track.
Yes.
It shouldn't be. It's wrong to think of it that way. And I think the value of, like, that college experience is really around the evolution. And you know, it's hard to defend because it's quite ephemeral and, like, hard to quantify. It's like, how do you put a bunch of people together, peers, right, thinking together, that challenge each other on multiple levels, along with interesting professors, lecturers, whatever, around subject matter that's interesting. Good stuff comes out of there. And that evolves you as a human being. So it's quite abstract. But does it make you a better, whatever, you know, whatever your chosen career track? not directly. It's not like one to one.
Yeah.
So I think there's something in that. Definitely on the certifications. Like I studied economics, and like I don't, you know, actually, if anything, what's happening in the world now is like, you know, that macro 101 course is just like tossed out the window. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Inflation is like made up, and it doesn't
seriously
pump enough money. It doesn't matter. But anyway, but I think that abstract thing of interaction between group of peers with very different opinions from very different backgrounds that are thrown together and live together, I think that's invaluable. I would never trade that. Would I trade the instruction part? Do I think that's like, yeah, I think there's huge room to kind of rethink that, maybe unbundle the college experience.
I mean, there's a lot of people talking about how only freshmen will now go to universities, whereas the rest of the classes will be delivered online.
I think that's very sad. You know,
it like, would be, right?
I hope that's not the case, because I think that is the point of the education. It's not the delivery of knowledge. Yeah. And I think so many people miss that because like it's so hard to quantify. How do you, you know, it's, you know, at least when you finish your, you know, Econ 101, you know, 110, 115, 120, you have your degree and you move on and you know what you finished. But how do you say you've actually experienced, you know, a great conversation about, I don't know, you know, I had like once a great conversation with like my German philosophy, 18th century philosophy professor about like, you know, the evolution of politics in the US. And that was much more instructive to the entire way I think about like politics in general than any course I could have taken, than any, and about political economy generally. And it was with other people taking the course as well in like a small setting. So that's like invaluable. I can't, how do you recreate that, you know?
Yeah. Since we're talking about education, I've noticed that, I haven't noticed, but you know, we went to the same high school. I realized that going to this particular high school in Jordan for me has been tremendously useful. I mean, we all have love-hate relationships with our high school days.
Yeah.
Now that I'm working, you know, and I'm in a business where I get to network with people all the time on different levels, on different fronts. Do you find that having been graduated from ABS, has it been something that has particularly helped you professionally? Or do you find that whether you graduated from any other school, you would be where you are today? And the role of ABS particularly, like our high school, how specific was its role in where you are today professionally? Or was it indifferent, you know?
Yeah, I think, no, it's not professionally and personally, I think like totally foundational. But not, I think, so at the time, so I loved ABS. I loved like high school. I really did, especially in hindsight. I think at the time, because, you know, I was like angry teenager, I wanted to hate it because I wanted to, right? Because you give some context. ABS is like this really product of its time. Like it's a very kind of elitist, very rich kind of like a high school in what is a very, very poor country, right? Jordan.
Right.
And it's sort of emblematic of how, you know, how class stratified that society is, and how, you know, you have this school because it combines a lot of like those wealthy families, they put their kids there, they congregate around it, is really the like an embodiment of what is wrong in society as a whole, of the inequalities right. that exist in society as a whole, more so than anywhere else in the world. And you can tell, like, you know, the school we went to is quite liberal, right? Like yeah. the student body is liberal, the families are very liberal, right? But the country is quite conservative. So it's not just about income inequality. There's kind of like this...
dichotomy.
Yeah, yeah. And this bifurcation, right? It's like very... And everything was emblematic in the school. And so I had a great time. I loved the school. And yeah. Don't get me wrong. But I wanted to kind of put my issues with like the wider societal construct into the school. So like my college essay, for example,
yeah.
was about like class struggle inside the school.
Oh, wow.
Right. So like so I kind of have that thing about it, but at the same time, I think it was foundational and helped me in multiple ways. First, like the school in kind of the more direct ways is like the school was very good at empowering people, mm. right? And like, I had great teachers. I had like some teachers till today that really kind of shaped the way I think about stuff.
Same here.
So I had like great history teacher, Brian Ellis, who like just, you know, really informed me like how to kind of think about things. I had a great English teacher, Diane Selleck, who like helped me think through we did like literature and like and how to kind of like enrich my life, right? And really pushed me on multiple intellectually and didn't treat us as kids. Like I felt like, you know, empowered. I think one thing that's, you know, very interesting about the school is, for example, you know, we'd have a school play or like a talent show or whatever, like a school production and whatever it is. And what was interesting about them, it wasn't like teachers like instructing us what to do. It was entirely student led at every level, the set design, the lighting, the acting, the direction, the music. So in a school of K through 12 of 800 to 1,000 people, you had like 500-600 of the students working on a production,
right?
Fully empowered to do their own. And I think that's extremely, it really helps you evolve and develop as a human being.
It's to what you were saying earlier, when you're collaborating with other students, with teachers to get an event off the ground, whether it's a talent show or an open day, fun fair, student council, all that stuff. For me, is what I remember from high school. I don't remember necessarily the content.
Exactly, yeah.
But the teachers have been instrumental. Khalil Karaji, I would love to see this teacher again. You know, up until now, I feel like a lot of the things that I consider myself proud of, that I succeeded in life, has a lot to do with how much motivation he gave me to make me think that I'm smart or that I'm witty. And when you hear that at a young age, it's the kind of thing that could, you know, potentially serve you at an older age. But also more importantly, now that I've been to New York, London, San Francisco, here in Dubai, it's an invaluable network. Wherever you go in the world, you'll have an ABS alum somewhere that will either be, you know, a friend if nothing else, but also a potential client or a potential business partner. And that's something that I don't see with other schools, not just in Jordan, but also like friends of mine who are American or European. They don't seem to have what we have in Jordan. It's a Jordanian thing first and foremost, in my opinion. But also if you're Jordanian and you also went to one of those handful of schools, whether it's ABS or Montessori.
Yeah.
And it's something that I'm starting to appreciate more and more as I start to travel around and realize how invaluable it is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't think I've like done that so much, but I see that, like, and it's nice to kind of have that network and yeah, it's a great play. And I always think of it like really, really positively.
Tab, let me ask you something about investing again. I recently came across a term that's been recently coined, at least I recently found out about it, which is zebra startups. Have you heard of zebra startups?
No, I've not. So
zebra startups are unlike unicorn startups. Unicorn startups are like all about scale, trying to grow, have eyeballs, billions of users, billions of dollars. Zebras, and I saw this in an article, a Forbes article around three or four months ago, are two things, black and white like zebras. One is that they are profit generating, so they're not just all about scale at the expense of burning capital. So they are for profit and profit generating. And two, they're about creating impact. And the article goes on to say that there is a new perspective towards startups. That enough of this sort of like scale at any cost, eyeballs at any cost. Let's look at smaller, impactful startups that will have an impact on the community in one way or another. Or it's not just
when you say impact, you mean like social impact, or you mean like what kind
it's
of
for
impact?
A good, it doesn't have to be
for good, for a
yeah,
good cause.
Okay. It's a good product. It's not just there for the sake of making money. One way or another, this product helps humanity, community. It doesn't have to be a social entrepreneurship, like a philanthropic nonprofit. So that's the thing why it's called a zebra, because it's for profit and it's also for a good cause or has a good impact.
Right, right.
I think more importantly, the idea is that this is now becoming the attention of investors, at least in Y Combinator and in Silicon Valley, is that nobody cares so much anymore for the big unicorn types, and there's a shift towards the zebra startups. So do you see this here in the region, or are we still like classic 2000, early 2000s?
No, I think like we're not seeing that as much. But I take issue with the idea that like purpose of a... So like there are two things here, I think. So the first is, you know, the way to create impact is not through setting out saying I'm going to have an quote unquote impactful, social impactful organization. Mm. You build the business around a narrow thing that you're looking to solve. And then once you've solved it, you know, you want to kind of believe that what you're solving for makes things better, right? In some way, shape or form, employs people, like solves a problem, is efficient, etc. But trying to kind of like create these double bottom line stuff. It's just, you know, you end up doing neither, right? You end up not really having impact, you end up not having a business, and you end up just kind of like there. And I think the story of like a lot of companies in sub-Saharan Africa are like that. So like, I don't know if you know like a company called M-Pesa.
Money remittance. Yeah.
So yeah. Like one of the most successful old company came out, and you know, they didn't go out because they wanted to kind of create impact. They want to solve a very specific problem, which is that, you know, there's for a lot of merchants and people like buying stuff, they don't, and there's you know, carrying cash is dangerous in Kenya, especially for if you're a migrant worker from the rural areas and you wanna kind of send cash if you work in the city, you wanna send cash back to your family in a rural area, you'd have to give it to somebody on a bus, and these buses were getting hijacked, and you know, so they want to solve that problem and build a business doing that, right? But if you set out to kind of do, I want to have impact, let me find an impact, you know, I want to, it pollutes the message, it convolutes it, and you kind of lose focus. So I'm always a bit suspicious of it. However, I think you're touching on a more important trend, which is that I think it's like, it's a macro question rather than the micro question. So zebras, as you're saying, is more a micro question. I think the macro question is our understanding of like, how the economy functions and of capitalism is very narrow, right? It's about how do I maximize utility, and by utility, how do I maximize my my pocketbook? Like, how do I make my bank balance bigger? And you know, if you think about like, you know, what underlies that, it's like a Jeremy Bentham, he's like a say 18th century philosopher, and that kind of like what sets out the whole one of the basic tenets of capitalism is how do we maximize utility for everyone. At some point in the 19th, early 20th century, people recognized that utility meant money, because you can't measure happiness. But in its original form, we meant happiness.
Right.
So I think we're getting to a stage now for many, many reasons, income inequality, et cetera, where it cannot just be about
money.
So utility as we understand it, we are as human beings like driven by maximizing utility, and we should maximize it for as many people as we can.
Yeah.
But it's not just money, right? Like there are much more powerful drivers or other drivers that kind of affect the way we construct our society and think about our political choices, our social choices. And I think there needs to be sort of a reframing of our almost like political economy around that.
Yeah.
And to rethink what we do that. Maybe the zebras is a way of expressing that, but that's it's almost like a very narrow way to do it. I think it's a much wider rethink of the way the economy operates.
Definitely the making profit part of the zebra, aside putting the social impact aside, I think the idea, I think a lot of investors are starting to see through the facade of it can't just be about growth at the expense of capital.
Oh, yeah. That like growth at any cost, that was dying anyway.
Right.
COVID's killed it, right? Like that grow unit economics, you know, highly unprofitable unit economics. That was dying. That was a slow kind of death. And like everything else, COVID just accelerated it.
Yeah.
But like people want to see like, if not profitability, path to profitability, like on like clear unit economics, clear kind of path towards that. I think that's super important, and in that way, like the crisis has kind of helped clean this out, you know.
And anyways, even to what you were saying earlier, at an individual level, you need to grow through, you know, one framework is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You need to first make money to experience happiness at its basic level and being content with life. But after you make, there's so much money you could make at one point in life, no matter who you are, before you start to need to create impact to your society,
exactly,
or directly to your relatives or your direct contacts first, and then if you have it in you, beyond that to your community and then to the rest of the world. So it looks like we live in a world where there's an abundance of cash, an abundance of I wouldn't say abundance of cash, but there is an abundance of maybe money is not so limited and to the point where you need to that's the equation of life. So once you've made some money in your life and you see, okay, well, yeah, I have enough of it, I need to do something beyond just making money at this point. I need to do something that's bigger than me, right? And maybe it's a creative outlet, or maybe it's about
100%. And I think that's what you're seeing, and that's kind of this evolution of this kind of quote unquote capitalist model, right? Like I think, you know, you can explain I think in the region, we're not there yet, because like we're still vast developing in the Middle East, right? In the markets, at least where we invest and we, but like, if you look at the developed world, I think you can explain, a lot of like the political movements there, like populism, et cetera, by the fact that people are not just driven by that, right, anymore. They're driven by wanting to have like social cachet, cultural cachet, like cultural power, to have like cultural fulfillment in their society, etc. So once you reach a certain level of income per capita, you start seeing that like at this point, when income inequality rises, you start seeing the rise of disgruntled groups around this kind of concept, you know, whether that's on the left or on the right. Like, and I think it's exactly what you're saying is, you know, people want to have, there are needs that that capital alone or income does not solve for. And those are cultural, they are social, they are impactful, they're very local. And I think now we're just seeing like the effects of that.
Yeah.
Happening like in the developed world, because they've reached, like, if you look at like average income per capita in the US, it's like $65,000 a year, which is quite high, even though it's quite unequal, but that's why inequality matters so much there and what drives people.
Yeah. I mean, one person that really inspired me when I was starting to dig into this particular topic is Chamath Palihapitiya.
Yes, yeah.
So how familiar are you with his work?
That was a great CNBC interview when he said, like, let them all go bust, like,
Yeah.
So it's correct.
I thought I heard that his social impact, it's called social capital.
Social capital, yeah.
Social capital failed, is what I heard.
It didn't. I think he just chose to kind of do it himself. He didn't want to raise money. He wanted to do it himself. And I think he does it, and he's investing and stuff. And
do you have any like particular? He's in the VC world. He's probably one of the people I look up to a lot. Yeah. He sounds inspiring. He sounds genuine.
I think he is, and I've not met him, but I think from everything I've seen, I think you're right.
And so, when you started getting into VC yourself in the world of being a venture capitalist, who was the inspiration, or maybe it wasn't an actual VC, but what inspired you to say, "I want to become a venture capitalist"? Does anybody continue to inspire you down that path?
So the honest answer is no.
Okay.
Right? That I there was not like I was like 16 and I thought I read this book and like, oh, I want to be that when I grow up.
Okay.
Right? Like that did not happen.
Okay.
I
put you on the spot there, but
No. I totally stumbled into this. Like,
okay.
It's the only thing I've really ever done. I think what attracted me, if you want to kind of tie it back, what attracted me to this, especially when I started, there was nothing out here.
Yeah.
Nothing. It was like the first seed fund that worked on like here in Dubai, like in 2007. Absolutely nothing to invest in. And like we were still kind of the cusp of it. What attracted me to is the concept, which, you know, speaking back to this kind of like we were talking about ABS, is I hate the idea of sacred cows, that you have these industries that are, or people or whatever, that they are, you know, they're in the unassailable, right? That no, we'll never have, I remember this, like we'll never have, we'll never, like something like Kareem, I'm using Kareem as the example, but
Kareem, the startup.
Well, let's go even before, like, you know, Souq.com, like who's going to buy stuff online? You know, all the retailers here are do their own stuff and like whatever. And then, you know, something like Souq just explodes, you know? You know, so I like that.
Being irreverent. Able to spot something that nobody else believes in.
No, that's just like going against, you know, what is established, and this is just the way it is. But no, I love the creative destruction in that. Okay. I've always liked a different context, and then I kind of was lucky. I found a career in it, like doing that in a constructive way. So I think that's what attracted me to the concept.
Yeah. And since you started investing, do you feel like there are specific investments that you've done? I know you spoke, you described the most obvious ones. Kareem is one of them. I think Mum's World, Little Bits, these are some of the investments that you've done. Do you feel like you've missed the boat on some investments that you were either, I'm not going to say too arrogant to believe in them, but maybe they didn't for some reason check boxes that you thought needed to be checked, and then they surprised you against all odds that they turned out to be like a successful company that you missed the boat on? Or do you feel like you don't have any regrets on opportunities that may have passed under your radar screen?
No, I think so. I don't regret stuff that I've missed, because you know, you make the best decision. You regret if the process was bad.
Yeah.
Like if, no, we should have thought about this better, but we didn't. But if you thought about the right way and you missed stuff, that's going to happen. It's the nature of the business. I think there are kind of lots of great companies that we, you know, that came through that possibly didn't push through any. But like, many. I mean, I don't know where to start, really. Yeah.
Or maybe another question I want to ask you is, where have you made an exception to what would otherwise be your criteria for a bare minimum requirement for a team and a company before you could consider investing in them? Have you ever made an exception where either the team or the product or the stage that you were at was not sufficient for you to invest in, but something about that team or something about that company or that opportunity made you think, I wouldn't normally invest in this, but I'm going to go ahead and invest in this, make a decision or push for it. Do you have anything of that sort?
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot. I mean, not to be boring, but like the Careem one was that, because we came in like, you know, it was quite big already and it was beyond like our, it was relatively big. And you know, we had a lot of pushback on Careem, like, you know, shouldn't do it, like, what, Uber, you know, it's never going to work. You know, there was like, there was, that one actually had a lot of pushback. So like that one, I think is something that, like, you know, surprised by the scale of its success. I knew it was going to be successful just on the team, but like surprised by the scale of success. And it was not the typical thing we'd done at the time. So that's kind of one. We invested early in a company in, called, well, we just made a, we invested in like Lunchon, you know, which is now Munchon.
It's one of our ABS.
Also ABS.
Yeah.
And that was really a bet on the team. I didn't fully understand the...
So it's Dana's brother, right?
It's Mohammed Zabin.
Mohammed Zabin, sorry. So yeah. Dana Zabin, Mohammed Zabin, and there's her brother. And who is their co-founder?
There's also Dana. So like, there's okay. like Dana Bakifa. So that's, I couldn't really understand the, I kind of understood the business model, but I wasn't sure how it would work. But it was really a bet on them.
Okay.
I really liked them as a team. And like, so it worked very well. And I think the company's doing really well. But I think there's no like, it's not like a checklist. Like, there is a checklist, but it's not, you never adhere to the checklist.
Yeah, so it's more of an art than a science, basically.
Yeah. I think nobody's figured out. If someone's figured this out, like, you know, I'd love to meet them.
Because it's funny, because when you're a founder, you meet maybe a handful of investors in your journey, especially early stage. Maybe you meet 10, 20, 50 investors, 100 investors throughout the entire lifetime of your startup.
Yeah.
And to you, it's a decision of, you know, it's what will make or break your dream, your baby. But investors get to see like thousands, as you said, 8,000 startups is what you got to see. So it's somehow, I feel like the experience perhaps becomes a little bit relatively to the founder, the investor's relationship to that is less personal. For the founders, it's far more personal, far more about their dream. For investors, it's like, I'm going to see 8 entrepreneurs today. I'm going to invest in one or two of them, maybe at the end of the month after I see a couple of hundred. So it makes there's an imbalance in that relationship in that sense. One party really requires the other gets to choose and pick out of a big pool. So I wonder, what is it that you think some founders do too much of or too little of that makes them fail in getting the funding?
I think it's not about the, I mean, people like try to think about like the, like, is it something in the pitch? Can I make it better? I think it's like, if you have a great company and the person sitting across the room from you is of a similar mindset, you will get funded. So it's less about, you know, the best kind of sequence of the pitch. And like, some people are also natural salesmen. So you can easily, people who can sell, they sell well.
But is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, if they're humble, it naturally makes
there
them...
There can be too much selling.
Yeah.
And it makes you actually, it's a red flag. This is too salesy.
Yeah.
This is like too, this is the best thing in the universe, right? So I think you kind of balance that a bit. I think you're right about this kind of moment in the pitch where, you know, for on the investor side, it's like a 10-minute conversation. But on an entrepreneur, that's like, you know, a lot goes into that. And I'm very guilty of this. It's like, oh, I'm like within 10 minutes, like, I think I know, like, you know, in the back of my head what's happening. Yeah. And so sometimes the counterpart can read it easily. And so you come off like arrogant, aloof, like, you know, so. And it's really a wrong interaction. And I think a lot of these interactions with investors come off like that. And I think we're always trying to kind of fix that and find a better way to interact with founders. The other thing is, though, I think the nature of the dynamic is changing. It's less about the investors sitting there back and saying, I like you, I don't like you, and I like you. I think it's more about the best founders, best companies now, people are competing to get into those deals, which is very healthy and is the right way this should go. It shouldn't be about us, the quote-unquote, the investors deciding winners and losers. It should be the founders picking which investors they want to work with.
How much power do they have in making that decision when investors show up with a certain pool of investors behind them? Is it like a situation where the founder can say, I don't want these guys?
Yeah, it happens all the time. It never used to happen in the region. This is a new phenomenon because they're now like much more mature and founders who've been through like cycles with different companies who have like great credentials and people who are not necessarily entrepreneurs before, but coming from great backgrounds, starting up businesses. And that are, you know, our business model is great, they're great, the team is great, and there's, you know, more capital in the region, still much lower than elsewhere in the world, but there's a lot more capital now. And so people, like, you know, jostle for that. So you want, you know, what you really want to end up with is the founder saying, I want to work with this guy. This is who I want to work with because they can help me with A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Right. And, you know, when things go bad, which they almost always go bad at some level, you know, they'll have my back. And I think that matters tremendously.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that also came out of this discussion that Philip was having with Fadi is that founders are becoming more reasonable with the valuations that they would otherwise ask for. Like they were previously, there was a lot of hyperbole about the space and overvalued startups. And now perhaps due to the pandemic, valuations have become more reasonable, and that's obvious.
But it's coming back up because as the public markets like have gone crazy, people are benchmarking against that, so you have the same kind of like valuation inflation.
Correct, but I'm wondering how much when you're a startup, when you have operational expenses and you need cash, and that cash is sitting with investors that, as you said, can invest in public securities or they can go ahead and save these startups. But are we potentially on the cusp of what might become as cash depletes for startups? Could the imbalance be such that they don't just become reasonable, the valuations, but we might start to see some predatory investments from VCs that would, you know, there will be hostile takeovers or extremely low valuations and down rounds? Is this potentially something that...
Possibly, but I think that's not the right... I think it should be more binary, but I think that might happen a bit. But I think it should be bad companies should fail. Companies should fail more, actually, in our... You know, there are too many companies that are just around because they're around. Mm. Like the founders, it's kind of, it's easy for me to sit here and say like, fail and do it again, right? But that's actually what makes somewhere like Silicon Valley so powerful, is that, you know, you fail and you start again, fail and start again. Obviously, the cost of failure here is much higher than over there, either legally or whatever, culturally as well. But I think that matters a lot.
Yeah.
So I think there's room for, and you're already seeing like companies are failing, right? Like more and more, right? Yeah. Which is fine, and that's a natural. I mean, it's fine. It's easy for me to say it's fine because I'm not the one losing my job, right? And I work there. But I think if you take like a macro view, the more failure, the more recycling of the talent there, the more you'll end up with better outcomes. And I think that's what we're hoping to get into, kind of like a stride of that.
Very cool, very cool. Taib, and I want to ask you one last thing outside of the world of investment. Mm. What do you do? So we used to play in the same band. You were the lead guitarist playing all the funky solos and I was just playing the chords. What do you do in your personal time in Dubai now? You've been investing in, all I've known about you is that you've been investing in startups and you've been in the investment world since we met in Dubai. Are you still playing guitar? What's your creative outlet?
I still do, not as much as I used to. I go through phases, so like I play like a lot and then I forget about it, and then it kind of 3-4 months pass and then it kind of dies.
Okay.
And then you lose the skill, because it's all about practice, right? You lose the skill set, you try to bring it back. There's nothing like playing with people. That is like, because it's like there's this kind of unspoken language between people, like in people in a band or like people who are playing music together.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of cues you can get from each other.
Yeah.
That's really, I love living in that kind of moment, right? So that, you know, I wish I did more of that. I don't, but like we do sometimes. I do a lot of, I read a lot, but I listen to like
audio. Podcasts.
Podcasts and audiobooks. So if I'm on an audiobook kick, then I'll go like 3 months, just listen to books. And then if I'm on a podcast kick, then I'm just like, because there's a finite amount of time. So I probably listen to like 2 hours a day of audiobooks easily. And my other outlet is like, I love walking even in the heat. So like I walk like an hour up to 2 hours a day.
Possibly while listening to podcasts as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think like later, and I wish I did this earlier, but like later, I'm a bit older. I wish I did this like 10 years ago, but like 3-4 years ago, I started like, you're taking like fitness seriously.
Yeah.
So like, I
look great though.
Thanks. I wish I did like 10 years ago, I'd be like in much better shape.
Yeah.
But, you know, I go to the gym like 5-6 times a week.
Since you're talking about podcasts, obviously I'm new to the space. This is like my third episode. You know, I'm loving it. I love listening to podcasts. We were speaking earlier before we went live about the podcasting in the region, how it's still very nascent.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned that there's some investment in that space that you've...
Yeah, I think there's some great companies like trying to do stuff. So like there's a company called Finial Media.
Finial?
Yes.
Okay.
There's also Kerning Cultures.
Yeah. They've been around for a while.
I think there are a few others actually that are kind of building on the medium.
Yeah.
I think no doubt it's a very interesting industry, and I think, you know, it works elsewhere and it's going to work here. I think the challenge here is that on a per capita basis, spending on advertising generally, any medium, is lower here than elsewhere in the world, even in equivalent levels of economies. And there are kind of like long historical complicated stories for that, reasons for that. So it's harder to extract on a per capita basis or on per stream basis the right revenue to make it work, which is a bit, you know, but if you have enough scale, you can always kind of go over that. And then, you know, subscription is the other way. But it is a challenge in the region.
Which is weird because from the little that I know about online media consumption in the region, it's supposed to be the highest all around the world.
It's not a consumption issue. It's it's a fragmentation issue. So you have, it's a funny story. It starts with like TV, actually. So like you have, and this is changing very rapidly, but it started with TV advertising, like the most unsexy thing ever, right? So the bulk of advertising dollars from like the large, you know, FMCGs like Unilever, P&G, whoever it is, right? The, you know, who have wide advertising, they spend less on TV. They spend historically less on TV advertising than they have everything else, because there's no rating system, and there's no rating system because the ratings, you know, the television NBC is not local; it's regional. But you have to have like a pan-regional government body to set up the rating system.
Right.
Right. And so that never took off. And that kind of made advertisers pull back in a very, very big way.
So Ipsos does that now, right?
So Ipsos is like, you know, it's, you know, instead of having like a rating system, Ipsos is like, what, let me ask you, what did you watch on TV 2 weeks ago between 6 and 7 p.m.
Yeah, yeah. I did media planning for the Pepsi account in OMD. So the rate, and I think there's also a conflict of interest because the same owners of Ipsos are also the owners of the,
But like, let's take it at face value. Like, do you remember, like, I don't remember what I watched on TV a week ago on Wednesday night, like at 8:30 p.m.
Yeah.
You know,
why don't we have a people meter here? Is that what it's called?
People meters. Yeah. There's one in the UAE, but it doesn't matter. It has to be like, it has to capture 200, 300 million people because that's the nature of it.
Right.
And so you have that. So you have a lot of fragmentation. You have also a lot of fragmentation in advertisers. So to get like where it's powerful when it's like 300 million people and you're advertising for that as a whole, rather than you're advertising for like 30 million people in Saudi, 10 million people in the UAE, 5 million in 10 million in Jordan. Like it doesn't scale.
Yeah, fair. Khaled, first of all, it's been like around an hour and a half. So we want to thank you for your time for coming. Is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with about Nuwa or about what you're planning to do next that we haven't covered?
No, I think we're good. I think like we're learning and we're evolving, and anything we can. Love to hear from founders all the time. And if we can be better, we'd love to hear how. And I think we're announcing another 2 investments in the coming weeks.
Nice.
Maybe a third also, a fourth as in overall after. So I think we're progressing and we're hoping to kind of be good partners to founders in the long run.
Well, I wish you all the best. If there's anything I can do individually to contribute to the success of Nuwa Capital, you know, I used to work as a management consultant. I've always wanted to work with you somehow. So keep me in mind. Awesome. Now after Corona, I have some extra time to help out and work. So I wish you all the best, my friend. And thank you so much for coming here.
Awesome. Thank you. So much. Thanks.